So this is class 3 of the biblical financial class. My name's Tim Hancock. I would appreciate you guys talking to me today. That's helpful. The first thing that we do is obviously we'll review where we've been. So we talked about wealth the first week. We decided that wealth is okay. You just have to look at your heart condition. And from that, we understand that we as Americans are incredibly wealthy in a comparative sense. And then if you take a group of Americans, we can all have different things, but God gives us what we can handle, right? So that was part of that. And also we looked in a little bit about just because you might be wealthy doesn't necessarily mean you're blessed. A lot of people that have a lot of money, have wealth, don't actually have a very blessed life. They can actually be very miserable in their lives. Then Andy talked about being a good steward, protecting what God has given you last week, being wise with your finances, which means I think a lot of it has to do with knowledge. If you're not going to understand how finances work, then you're not really going to be able to be wise with it. And then basically honoring God through how we handle our finances. And that's something you can do by no matter how much money you make. You can be very poor and you can manage your finances in such a way that God's honored at all times. And you're going to make mistakes. And we'll talk about some fun mistakes today that we can make. And I'll do some math. And Andy can help. Did you bring your calculator?
I do bring a calculator.
Okay. If you don't have one, an HP 12C is a really nice one to get. You still have yours?
I do.
Yeah, okay. Sorry. So this week's perils of money. So to start off with perils of money, does anybody know what perils of money can be? Peril being an immediate danger. So when you think of money, you don't usually think of, oh no, danger. But what are some immediate perils of money? So serious, immediate danger. The love of money. All right, so there's the first one.
Idolatry.
Yep. I'm king of the awkward silence, so. I'll wait on you.
Greed.
Okay, so I have the list because, you know, I studied. Lack of contentment. So obviously you would not be content with what God's given you. You trust in yourself over God. Andy's done this. I've done this. You've worked with people at the bank that have just obscene amounts of money, just cash on hand that they don't really know what to do with. That, you know, oh, I'm trying to find out if I want to buy this or buy that or invest here or invest there. And when you talk to these people, they're just on a different wavelength. You can tell that they believe that whatever they have in that account is what is going to protect them. And it's really sad because I've dealt with all the peoples that have had a lot of money that have gone through terrible divorces, and then that money's just gone. It's gone in an instant because you end up going through this whole horrible situation. But you'll also be willing to sin to keep or get your money. So I've worked with those guys too that shade the truth. When we were lenders, we worked with a lot of guys that lose their job because they would just kind of violate just enough of the policy that they'd get fired. So we had a lot of people we were surrounded with like that. You get very prideful. Hey, look at me. Look at my fancy car, that kind of thing. And then it goes the other way too. Then you can have poor financial discipline. So you love money doesn't necessarily equate to you having money, right? So just because you like it doesn't mean you get it. So a lot of people may have love of money but not actually have the ability to gain a lot of it. So then you put yourself into where you're going to get into debt, and we'll talk about debt today and credit cards, things like that. And then the big one, right? Marital discord. So who has ever argued about money? Oh, not me. Come on, be brave. Somebody has. I mean, even if it's, you know, I can't believe you went to Starbucks and bought a $9 cup of mocha, whatever. But so I've had people like that I've dealt with that, you know, they argue over these small things, you know, the big things, you know, the house payment, the car payments, those things they don't argue about, but they argue about, really, we need another pair of high heels, those kind of things, or we need another pair of sneakers, just, you know, Jordans. So marital discord, you know, the strife that's created by money, it's very challenging to work through. So there is a biblical marital class after this. We've talked about that. So Money Magazine, these are all secular things, I know, but Money Magazine did a study with 1,010 married adults. I was pretty sure that's 505 couples. All of them, 25 and older, all of them made $50,000 or more. And 70% of them admit at least through the survey, that they fought more over household chores, the time they spent together, sex, snoring, and what's for dinner. So I know everybody, everybody fights over what's for dinner. So the question to you is, do you fight over money, and in what way? So who fights over money? We already kind of established we all do, but in what way? So how do you fight about it? Little jabs, big arguments, blow-ups, any volunteers? Volunteers? Like deacons who might speak out?
I find it more the awkward silence about money. So we're going to not discuss it and feel like that's okay.
That's a true thing. I've counseled people that have gotten married, been married for 4 or 5 years, and they don't know what debts each other has. So, if we don't talk about it, it doesn't exist. Student loans, so guys who are in or going to college with student loans, when you meet somebody and you get married, there's going to be this awkward moment where you'll get out your statement list and go, here's how much I owe the government for my subsidized, and here's my unsubsidized, and how much do you owe? And then you'll feel like a winner if they owe more than you, because that's how it works. That's how it works. And you might get lucky to meet somebody that pays them off for you. Ooh.
Hey, I paid off.
She did. She's gainfully employed. Gainfully employed. I was making a joke. So the personality will affect how you argue about it. So very passive people will tend to not argue about it because they don't want to address it. Whereas if you're more aggressive in your attitudes and things, that you throw the checkbook at them and say, I don't believe what you're doing. These things get heated. Power plays, I don't know if, hopefully nobody in here does this, but one person can usually control the other with the money. I don't know if you've ever ran into that.
Have you seen all of that when people have banks or loans and things?
Yes.
It evolves in front of you.
Yeah, and we'll get into some stories, because I think me telling you what's in the Bible is great and it's wonderful, and you can draw financial principles out of it, but real world situations where you see how people really are and kind of see how we've responded to them, I think it helps give you, kind of shines a light on what really goes on in relationships. Children, this back to the power play kind of thing, is I've known people that, they can control their spouse through how they treat their children. So we're going to spend over here, but we're not going to spend on something you might think is important. So you can control each other that way. And then there's always extended family. If you have some families, I've dealt with a guy that's was well off, made good money, but had a family that was not, and they would constantly come at him and say, I need your help with this, and I need your help with this, and it's very important things to them, but he always felt guilty, because how am I to judge what, if they come to me and say, I need $500 for a car repair, and I give them the $500, that's fine, but then if, they talk about, my cousin who needs money, and then they come to him and goes, no, your problem's not important enough to me, and he always felt guilty. So what did he do? He just didn't give to anybody. And that's not necessarily a biblical attitude. So marital discord, obviously, probably one of the biggest ones, one of the strongest ones. And I guess the next one is, we've already talked about a little bit, but what's the other major peril of money? I mean, there's a bunch of them, but what's the big one? The big one, obviously, is your relationship with your spouse. And the other one's going to be your relationship with God. So you basically at that point become a servant to money as opposed to a servant to God. So Larry Burkett says, and I'll just read it. Larry Burkett says, just as God can use money to enhance and direct our lives, our sins can shackle us and get us off course. Christians should learn to recognize the danger of money entanglements and financial bondage. So I think the key thing there is we need to learn about it. Ignorance is not an excuse kind of a thing. A lot of people struggle with the financial stuff because they don't like math or it's intimidating, but the internet's there, and it's very simple. If there's something you don't understand, Google it. There's the answer. If you'll look in Matthew 5, 25 and 26. So in the biblical days, if you didn't pay your bill, what happened to you? Debtor's prison. Does anybody want to bring it back? No. On an island, yet again. So Matthew 5, 25, 26. Make friends quickly with your opponent at law while you're with him on the way, to court, I guess, so that your opponent may not hand you over to the judge and the judge to the officer and you be thrown into prison. Truly, I say to you, you will not come out of there until you have paid up the last cent. So debtor's prison, basically if Andy owed me money or I owed Andy money, I couldn't get him thrown in jail. Sometimes you could, but depending on circumstance. Typically it was if you didn't pay your taxes or if you didn't pay a fine that the judge levied on you, those type of things. And what they would do is they put you in these workhouses and you have to work that money off. Because when you think about in today's culture, if I get put in prison, how am I going to pay back the money I owe? So it doesn't really work in our day and age. And mostly because the Constitution, the Supreme Court deemed it unconstitutional to house prisoners like that. And there's some loopholes in there. So here's the survey. Does anybody think debtor's prison is around today in America? We have one vote. I'm two. There's three. So yeah, debtor's prison exists today. And how it works is if you go to court, so basically this is a what if. If you go to court and you get fined, and that fine can be for a speeding ticket, not paying your child support, hopefully you don't have that problem here, any kind of fine that can be levied on you, if you don't show up for your court date, you're found in contempt of court. And then once you're found in contempt of court, they can actually legally put a bench warrant out for your arrest. 6 months, a year, 2 years, whatever later, you get pulled over for speeding, busted taillight, they run your information. Suddenly you find yourself in handcuffs being taken to prison because you're in contempt of court. Now, one of the stories I've read, and I don't know, I see this stuff, I guess, but this lady had done a similar thing. She had a $700 fine that she had not paid, and I forget what the fine was, but she did not pay it, and they did that same thing. They issued the bench warrant. It was 2 years later, and she was in Texas. And they ran her information, and she got arrested, and she spent 2.5 months in jail working it out. It ruined her life, and it was over some silly thing like speeding tickets and things like that. So debtor's prison exists. In Tennessee, it's actually legal, and we can have arguments about it, I guess, but it's actually legal to jail someone if they've not paid their child support. So we have a lot of foster parents here and things like that. So when I hear those things, I don't get too torn up about it, but it happens. But yeah, it's outlawed, right? Let's see. All right, so being a servant of money affects both the rich and the poor because it is a heart condition. One is not a slave to money while the other isn't. So basically, just because you have it doesn't mean you're going to be good about it. And just because you don't have it doesn't mean the same thing. So when you are looking at how should I treat my finances, you always chase it back to your heart condition. So the next kind of bullet point in the lessons here, and remember I'm using Whose Money Is It Anyway by MacArthur, but we talk about if you're a lover of money. So we talked about being a servant of money. We can also talk about being a lover of money. And those are very similar, selfish, greediness. Has anybody just been tired with money? Like you're just tired. Like you just don't care. I'm tired. Put it to the side and try and ignore it, which is one of the worst things you can do, but everybody pretty much just tired about it. I'm tired of talking about it. So question, you don't have your workbooks on page 30 if you do. We'll do question one. So this talks about your attitude towards money. Two things I asked of you. This is in Proverbs. Two things I asked of you. Do not refuse me before I die. Keep deception and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is my portion, that I not be full and deny you and say, who is the Lord? Or that I not be in want and steal and profane the name of God. So out of that verse, what is the danger of riches?
Forgetting where everything got to come from, for one.
Right. You forget where it came from. Everything's God's. You become content without God. I don't need God because I've got X amount of dollars in the bank, which could be temporary because it's God's money. And what's the danger of poverty on the flip side?
Tempted to steal or tempted to get what you feel are your desperate needs without God or breaking the law to get it.
Right, absolutely. And then there's all that comes with it, envy. You can be some of the greediest people I've ever worked with were actually below the poverty line. That sounds awful to say, but it's the condition of the heart. So if you look at God's attitude toward debt, because that's really what we're working towards is being a servant of money. If you're a servant of money, you probably owe somebody something. So here's the thing. Has anybody ever been in debt? Is everybody in debt? I mean, is anybody absolutely 100% debt-free? That means they don't owe a car payment, no mortgage payment, no student loans, not a credit card balance.
You got somebody back there.
Okay, so yeah. So what does Gage and Lucas and you guys have all in common? Are y'all under the age of 23? So, they, for now.
It's actually the prisoner thing you were talking about.
Yes. And Gage, I'm going to look into why you're not getting credit card offers. I'll take care of that for you. But you're not getting them. I'm going to get them to you. I sign up for anything on the internet. And I get $50 if I get a referral, so... So with debt, so show of hands, because I like this, I like the interactive part of it, is who thinks debt is not biblical? Or I guess who thinks debt is biblical, but what do you think? Is debt biblical? Having debt is okay. Yes, it's okay. Are you sure? You look at me like, I was asking it weird, I know. So yeah, it's fine. You can be in debt. That's great. We can all enjoy being in debt together. So if you're in debt, you've not really sinned. But you can sin by being in debt if you don't handle it right. If you don't pay your bills, depending on the reason you don't pay your bills, that's a sin, right? If you go out to the movies or you go out to buy new wheels for your car, or whatever it is, I'll pick on the young kids, then you've sinned because you've not done your financial obligation. So you can track that back to a condition of the heart, and it can be a sin. So the Bible actually doesn't prohibit borrowing or lending money. So that means Andy can lend all of us in here, and Andy's not done anything wrong. Actually, at the first church I went to, I was called evil because I was a lender, and it's something really hard. I think Jen will probably tell you more because I don't remember that stuff as much, but... people would attack me in classrooms and things like that because I would do mortgages for people, or I would, you know, as a money handler, or that kind of thing. But just other people. I was accused of doing. Well, here's some of the things I've done that with money that have been wrong. So now it's my turn. I did what you called extra LTV mortgage loans. You did them too. So I'm not the only one in the room. So and me and Pete were talking about this earlier in 2008 when the mortgage collapsed. That was basically a bubble that was created because of derivatives. I can talk about derivatives later if you like. What had happened was we did all these big loans, and we did them. We called them liar loans. We called them all kinds of fun things, and it was fun. It was a sport. I mean, I think it's a sport for us. And we didn't violate any laws, so we had clear conscience that we were doing everything legally. But what we could do is if the Gregories wanted to borrow some money, they could come see us, and I could say, what's your house worth? And they say, $100,000. And I say, okay, well, I can lend you 115% of that. And so I then put them in a mortgage at $115,000, knowing that their house is only worth $100,000. That's a bad position to be in. As long as everything's great, right? As long as things appreciate, your value's good, then everything's okay. But the minute that blip happens, you now owe more on your house than you can sell it for. And because of the way our economy works is when that blip happens, your house that was worth 100 is now worth probably like 80 or 90. So now you're way upside down in your house. That's negative equity. That's bad. Guilty. So for those subprime people, I was there to help you. Actually, I financed a drug overdose. I don't know if you remember this one. I struggled with that one for a while because I did a loan for a guy that went out and actually bought drugs and then OD'd in a hotel down the street from our office. And nothing like sitting at your office trying to book loans when the cops call you and say, hey, there's a receipt here from a loan you did for this guy. Can you tell us anything about him? And I didn't have a clue. So I know that's on him, but I had problems with that one. Actually, I did a loan for a lady to cover up, not knowing. I know I was doing it, but... I covered up a problem for her, and her husband found out about it. He beat her, and she came in and yelled at me. But anyway, those are things about bondage to debt. I can go on like this for days. It's really sad, but there's all these things. These are all problems that were bondage to debt, bondage to money, servants of money, that kind of thing. So these are real-world situations. So that's real uplifting, I know. Can anybody guess the most common cause of financial bondage? And I think it'll be kind of interesting to see what you guys say. What's that?
You mean like the heart cause?
No. Just how do I get in debt?
Spending more than I
have. Right.
Mortgages.
There you go. Abuse of credit, right? And everybody knows what credit is. Credit is what somebody somewhere says they trust you. I trust you this much, so I'll give you this much credit. So they'll talk about credit. Credit's obviously, it's easily available. That's why Olivia throws her son's credit card offers away, which is, I mean, that's a heroic thing. I would applaud you for doing it, because so many people, I've seen people carry credit card debt for years, and it's painful, it's ugly, and you can't get out of it. And I'll show you how it works. So you guys know. You can, and as soon as you do, they'll find a way to get you another one. Multiple banks carry multiple lines, and you can opt out all day long, but they'll still find a way to figure you out. I've opted out of probably 30, and I still get them. I think we get a lot less. I cannot get away from American Express. If anybody, please let me know. I've opted out twice, but I think you have to do it from each product they offer in some instance, so it's a trick. So credit is easily available. And what I mean is credit is, if you've got good credit, even if you don't have credit, you can walk into an institution and you can actually just apply, and they'll do starter loans, or they'll do secured credit cards, where you automatically start off in credit card debt. So if you're under the age of 25 and you don't have any credit and you get offered one of these, just say no. It's like a drug. Just say no. Because what they'll do is they'll say, okay, we'll give you, you have no credit, we don't trust you. So we're going to give you a $1,000 line of credit. Andy and I used to do these too. I'm dragging you into all this.
I see that.
We don't trust you. We give zero trust, but we're going to give you $1,000, but we're going to give us $500 right now. So they rack up a bill for you for $500, and you start paying on it. That's how it works. It's called a secured credit line. And what you do is you owe them a balance, and they cash advance it or whatever, or you can pay on it. There's different variations of how those things work, but basically they're going to give you a line of credit. They're going to give you a balance, and you're going to pay on it. So you pay to play. Average debts carried per household in America, and these will always kind of blow your mind. Average mortgage debt's $170,000. So that's per household. So that's what the average American couple carries. Auto loan debt's $27,000. Student loan debt, so if you're in college or recently out, you'll probably feel this one's $48,000. And then the one we'll talk about today is credit card debt in America is $15,762 per person. Per household. I've seen people with even more than that. So to relate, because I know we're not really talking a lot of biblical principles right now, but we'll get back to it. But to relate kind of the heart condition with credit card stuff, I've got some stories. Jen started it last week, so I'll tell the whole story. And it may be urban legend at Wells Fargo, but I used to work at Wells Fargo. When, I guess it's 2002, there's a story going around about this Harvard graduate that graduated with all these student loans. Just imagine what an average Harvard graduate graduate with. And what he did is he was getting all these credit card offers in the mail. So if Gage, you're employed, right? And you go to college. Where do you go to college at?
Pellissippi
State in Tennessee. He's probably not going to get the same offers as a senior at Harvard. There's just a difference. So this guy at Harvard was getting credit card offers on top of credit card offers. And what he started doing, he started to save them. And he developed a plan. He sat down one day and he filled out all his applications. And here's where it gets good, is that he was completely honest. I have no income. I'm living on my student loans. I don't have any assets. And he sent all these in, and everybody was giving him $7,500 and $15,000 credit card lines because they were hedging their bet. Here's a guy that goes to Harvard. He's probably going to be employed. Times are good. Economy's strong. He's going to get out of school, make a ton of money. Let's get him in debt today so we have his money for tomorrow. That's the way it works. So he got him back. Agree or disagree, he never broke the law. So he sat down, he sent them all in, and he got all these credit cards, and then he cash advanced them, which is one of the worst things you can do in the world. Don't ever cash advance a card. He cash advanced all these. He put the money in the bank. Then he goes to the IRS. What's the government say I can do with his money? So then he starts gifting it. He gives a large portion to his mom. He gives some to his aunt. And now he's assetless again. So he has no assets. And he goes and files bankruptcy on $170,000 in credit cards. And there's nothing anybody can do about it. So he walks away with a bankruptcy on his credit bureau, but then his mom and his aunt give him the money back. And they tried to get him for fraud, and they couldn't do it. They tried to put him in jail. It didn't work. He didn't break the law. He broke God's law, yes, but he did not break the law. And if you think this is a one-off, while I was looking for the article for this one, I found another one in 2015. A guy in Canada tried to do the same thing. He's in jail.
He didn't go to Harvard.
He didn't go to Harvard. He did not have the same luck. And the one difference is who did you just slam Pellicity? No, that was Andy Boyer, people. So he committed fraud on his credit applications because he lied about his job and his income. Whereas the guy at Harvard never told a lie. This guy in Ontario did. He got $95,000, I think, and is in jail. Good. So another one, do you remember the ladies that brought us lunch, or the lady and husband that brought us lunch for like 2 weeks? I think you may have moved on by then. I was hoping you remembered. So this lady, I'm on the phone. That was our job. We're on the phone. We talked to people. And I talked to this one lady, and I'm looking at her credit bureau, and we had a screen, and you could tab through her credit cards, and it just kept going and going and going. I never seen anything like this. And they all had, you know, 500, 1,000, 1,500. She had almost 50 credit cards in her name. And I called her, and I said, do you get tired of paying all your bills? She said, yeah, it's a part-time job just to pay my bills. And I said, well, you know, I sold her a loan. She's like, well, come on in, I'll clean it up. So her and her husband pull in. They drive matching Trans Ams. This is ringing a bell. And they come in, and they're very flamboyant and flashy. And, you know, talking to these people, they had the money to pay for it, but they would just, they had, you know, the Old Navy card and the Finger Hut. And they had all these crazy cards. Finger Hut's I'll tell you about it later. Don't get a Finger Hut credit card, you'll never get out of it. So she had all this debt, her and her husband, and they had the money to pay for it. However they got, that's fine. But she would sit down and just to pay her bills was, you know, she'd say it'd take me 10, 15 hours a month. And then I had always figured out that she was paying $150 a month in postage. Just, this was before the internet payment thing. And she would be mailing these checks out all the time. So I did a loan for them, and this, trying to tie this back into the sin of the heart kind of thing, is we did all this great stuff for them, right? So Wells Fargo gave them money. We cleaned it all up. We packaged it into a nice loan. We saved them money. We saved them interest. We saved them time. All these great things. And then I got promoted. I moved on. And I remember somebody called my office one day and was like, hey, do you remember this couple? And I was like, yeah, I remember them. They're like, man, they're in bad shape. Paid off $100,000. 2 years later, they're $70,000 into it again. So that was their heart, is they didn't have, they loved money. They loved acquiring things and spending things. And when I talked to her, you know, what is this debt for? It was just junk, you know, Old Navy clothes and novelty items and just junk, not anything. Because I think some people justify their credit card debt if they can point to the two or three things that they got from it. I had to buy a laptop for school. I went into credit card debt for it. So I want to take just a minute to show you how a credit card works. So obviously you'll get a credit limit. That can be $1,000, $500, $300, or it can be, I have seen 50s and 75s. So they're out there. If you get a black card, it's unlimited. Black card's through Amex, that doesn't matter. I'm off subject. So you'll have a due date, you'll have an interest rate. These are all things you understand. And does anybody want to share what their interest rate is on their credit card? Anybody? So Jen and I have had one for 14 years. I'm a good customer. I've never paid them a penny in interest, and we'll get into that. Mine's at 13%, 12.9. That's a good rate. That's an awful thing. So credit cards. Everybody knows what APR is, annual percentage rate. All right, so that's where they get you. They advertise your APR. And for my example, I think I'm using 16%. APR, sorry. Try and do three things at once. All right, so that's your annual percentage rate. So 16% sounds like a 16% sounds like a deal, right? That's the average credit card in America. Okay, the way they get you is they actually charge you a daily rate. just so I have my notes, so I don't mess up. Then you get your DPR, your daily percentage rate. Anybody math geniuses in here want to figure out how to do this? You take 16, that's your interest rate, and you divide it by the number of days in a year, and you get, no you don't, yeah, you get 0.043. So that's your daily rate. So that's what they're going to charge you on every day. So the next thing that you got to look at is if you have a balance on your credit card, we'll just say $500 because that seems like it's nice and low. So if you owe $500 on July 1st, they're going to calculate your daily percentage rate on that balance. And then if you assume that you make another purchase on July 15th, they're going to figure this out. So what we're doing is we're going to calculate your average daily balance. And this is just so you know, because you're all looking at me like I'm crazy. So if you carry $500 at your balance on July 1st, you've got 15 days, right? So that was your balance for 15 days. You add $500, we're going to go with 15 more days. It's really 16, I guess. So after you do that, this is how you figure your average daily balance. It's 500 times 15 plus 500 times 1,000, and you're going to get a total of $22,500. All right. 7,500. You with me? Okay. All right. So this all works out to be 750. Don't get hung up on the numbers. I'm sorry. So you take your average daily balance, right? $750, that's your average daily balance. That's how they're going to calculate your interest. So you do 750 times your daily rate times the number of days you carry that interest or that balance, and you get $9.99. It's really 7.5. If you want to be down to the thousands and thousands. So $10. That doesn't sound too bad, right? Not too bad. Everybody loves credit cards, right? All right, so now, if you do the same math on $15,000, I'll spare you the writing, your average daily balance then becomes, $15,000. Okay, so if you're $15,000 in credit card debt, that's what the average American has. So you can go home and do this and make yourself sick. $15,000, you're paying it off. You're not adding anything to it. You're going to have interest per month of $199.95. So that's $200 a month that you're just going to give to the credit card company. They use that same math on everything that has credit card involved in it. $200 a month. Now, the banks are real slick because do you know what rate or how they calculate your minimum payment? So if you've got $200 in interest is their guaranteed payment. They give you a low minimum payment, right? Low minimum payment. Well, they usually will do that between 1.5% and 2.5%. And there's a regulation that came out a while back that said they can't charge this. Do you remember? It's not Sarbanes-Oxley, it's the other one. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So the government said, Consumer Protection Agency, you may hear that sometimes, is that this is illegal because what they'll do is they give you an interest rate at like 16%, 18%, whatever that is. They give you this really low percentage minimum payment requirement. And if you just make your minimum payment, you'll actually never pay the card off. Your balance will actually go up depending on the size of it. Lots of variances. So what they've done is they said, you gotta be reasonable. You got 2.5%. So 2.5% is a great number. That will help you get your credit card paid off. And I did the math for you. So if you do $15,000 and then they add your interest to that because they're kind, right? That's $200. They calculate your minimum payment off that new balance. So just so you know, that's $380. So you'll actually pay more in interest than you will in your principal as you pay that down if you make the minimum payment. At $380 a month, that's 57 months, so call it 60, call it 5 years, and you're going to pay $6,500 in interest. So you think about that. If you get $15,000 worth of stuff, you're going to pay back almost half in interest. That's a pretty, pretty bad deal.
If you do that in 5 years, will you pay the balance off, or you still have that balance that you're still paying?
You'll pay it off if you pay 380. But if they're playing loose with these regulations, because I think the minimum is 2.15, if they play loose with it, it stretches it out to almost 10 years. So, and that's if you pay the minimum. I mean, if you pay extra, you can pay it off early, all those things. But really what you do is you put yourself into a position where you can't get out of credit card debt. So, and then you get into bankruptcy, and we may talk about some of that too. But back to love of money, because I hope that's informative. A lot of people don't think about it. So when you have a love of money, you're going to end up with a lot of problems, and a lot of those are going to be sinful issues. So does anybody want to confess what their sin is when it comes to love of money? Who loves money in here? Well, nobody's going to raise their hand, right? But I mean, we're Americans. I mean, yeah, I know not everybody's going to want to talk about this personal stuff, but a lot of people, if I'm going to play the odds, somebody in here has 10 credit cards in their wallet at various banks and financial institutions. And I say it with pretty good confidence because of the mix of people we have. And I would say because of the certain mix, it might be a little lower. But somebody's probably been there once before or is trying to get out of it there now. So though that's average. That's all average. So if you have that kind of an addiction, because it really can become an addiction, credit is an addicting thing, you can struggle with these things. So a lot of people, if you have a love of money, you'll have an assumed superiority. You deal with those guys. I'm better than you because I make more money than you. And it's really funny because there's always going to be somebody else who makes more than them, but they still have this air of bravado. You can actually develop a financial resentment towards others. I think less of people. That's a horrible place to find yourself, but you can look down on people because they may not have the same kind of job that you deem valuable. People do that a lot. You can have great frustration. The people I've dealt with money and without money, all share kind of these same common causes, is that a lot of times they'll just be frustrated. I'm frustrated because I don't have it and I want it, or I'm frustrated because I've got it and I don't know what to do with it. Now, if we're honest, we would rather not know what to do with it than not have it. But at the same time, they're focusing on their problems and not what they should be doing for God. Materialism, worry. Question?
No, I think it's interesting that all three of those are covered in 2 Timothy 3.
Yeah.
Don't be conceited. Fix your hope in God and what to do with it. Be generous and rich in good works.
And all the answers are right there. All these things are, I'm pointing out all the problems, and all the answers are obviously in the Bible. So it's exactly right. Is if you just do what God says, things are a lot easier. But that's not all the way, or not always the easiest thing. Worry was probably the biggest one I struggled with, and struggled with it for years. And we were fortunate. I was not paycheck to paycheck, but I never could seem to get my focus off of money. And I did that for several years. And I actually took the biblical counseling class here and worked through a lot of stuff, and it's helped me a great deal. I've got these people around me now, get rich quick people. Sometimes they get so focused and caught up in how do I make myself rich today, how can I step on somebody to do it if I have to, or what law can I skirt to get around it? And then it goes the directions of laziness. A lot of people, if you get content with the money you have, you just get lazy. You slack up on some things. Deceitfulness, greediness, covetousness, wasting time, all those things are things that will creep up if you have a true love of money. The wasting money is one that is kind of will be surprising to something, because if you have money to the point where you've got so much, it's natural to just waste it. Wasting it can be on whatever kind of vice you have, whether it be fancy coffee. I pick on coffee because I don't drink it, so it's real easy to condemn those who go to Starbucks because I don't go there. See, and I made somebody walk out again. Somebody might like Chick-fil-A, or somebody might like fancy shoes, or I like Chick-fil-A too. So I mean, you can throw all things that you think of, and these are sources of marital discord. You can say it's a waste of money. I'm not telling you not to go to Chick-fil-A, but at the same time, if you're struggling to make ends meet, maybe you shouldn't go to Chick-fil-A. But what happens is wasting that money can actually lend or trend you towards financial overcommitment. Whereas if you get comfortable in a certain lifestyle, right, if you're making money up here, that's all temporary, all under God's control. If that suddenly drops because you had to change jobs or you had some sort of hardship, well, you still have this lifestyle up here. And a lot of the sin nature of people trend to push back up towards that. And because you have good credit, you can easily do it. It's readily available. So that's in a nutshell, credit cards and love of money. Borrowing. So we all decided earlier that borrowing is not necessarily a bad thing. It can be done wrong. It can be done right. Borrowing in itself is not wrong, but obviously not paying it back is. Psalm 37:21 says, "The wicked borrows and does not pay back, but the righteous is gracious and gives." And when you start to really think about how you live your life, if you're a person who likes to give things, and I mean, it feels good to give, right? If you can help somebody out of a jam, or if you can anonymously give a gift to somebody to send them on camp or to whatever it is, those are things that'll make you feel good, right? Those are good things. You can take it too far. We all agree you can take it too far. But if you are, nobody will probably talk about this, but have you ever been in a position where you wanted to give but just couldn't financially do it? That's a hardship, right? So you have the right heart attitude, you just don't have the money to do it. If we started looking at it a lot of times, it's because of what we've done to get ourselves to that point that will prevent us from giving. So I have some questions, if you'll answer them. How can you tell if you have a love of money? What are some ways to, if you really look at your heart and look at what you and your wife or you and your husband do on a daily, weekly, monthly basis with your money, how can you tell if you actually love it or not?
I get out of the line.
Too fast, I was trying to drink. That's too fast, I was trying to drink. Yeah, you think about it a lot. You focus on it all the time. It consumes you. Does everybody check their checking account balance every day? Am I the only one? Okay.
I do.
Okay, yeah, okay. Thank you for your honesty. Does anybody check your 401k every day? No. We'll talk later. No. The market is the market, and if you want to talk about the market, because a lot's happened in the last 2 days, then
yeah,
sure.
I'll tell you all about it.
It's a long game. Don't focus on the short game. No active trading and no timing of the market. Those are forbidden in this class. So absolutely, focus on it. Anybody else? Again, I have the answers.
What happens when somebody takes away, when somebody takes it from you, your reaction to that?
That's a big one. Right. If somebody steals from you or cheats you, I know we've had, here's a tip. Here's a pro tip if you want to think about it. A family member contacted us and contacted the wrong one to ask a question about money. And he wanted to borrow some money. He wanted
$900.
A lot of money. And so I said, no, that's not what we do here. Give me a call. We'll go through what you need, how you need it, what you need it for, and all those things. So he called me. And, I was try to be really nice about it, but I was not going to just send him a check or money order or whatever it was. And he said, I need to pay this, and I need to pay this, and I need to pay this. I was like, well, here's what we're going to do. Can you cancel your cell phone bill? Yeah, I can cancel that. Okay, go cancel it. Set up a payment installment. Tell them you're going to pay them back over the course of the next 6 months. Guy was broke, lost his job, this whole thing. And so we took care of that. There went $250 of it. He's got to pay half his rent because he's in his roommate thing and all this. And I was like, okay, when's your rent due? We worked all that out, and he's starting a new job, so we timed all that out. Ended up giving him $300. And what'd he say to me? I will pay you back every dime. So I at least had been coming to church here long enough to know, no, wait, it's a gift. So because had I given him $300 with the anticipation of getting that money back, today's June 26th of 2016. I still have not gotten it back because I gave it to him, and it's fine. I helped him out. It got him to his new job. It kept him from getting kicked out of his apartment. That was a good thing. But he still, after I said, no, it's a gift, don't worry about it. No, I'll pay you back. And I said, if you want to, fine, but I'm not going to expect it. And he never did. And I'm happy about it because he went off and he's gone to church now, and he seems to have gotten his kind of act together. So good things happen when you help people, but be wise in how you do it. Cousin Bobby calls and says, I need $5,000. Don't just go, okay, here's a check. Talk it through. $5,000 is a lot of money. If you've got a cousin Bobby, that's a mooch. I'm sorry. So are you bent on making money any way possible? A lot of times we can ride the clock. That's a term that gets thrown out. Does anybody have a hourly job where they clock in, clock out? I work with adults, right? Like adult men who ride the clock constantly. And it's a thing. I mean, they've worked there 20 years and clock out and clock out when you leave. Or they'll find them talking over in the shop for 10 or 15 minutes. You ride the clock, Nathan.
No, this is just an example of that. Our pilots get paid by the hour.
Yes.
And they get paid from when the door closes to when the door doesn't close.
Right.
But many of them have figured out how to trick the system by pulling the right combination of circuit breakers so the machine sends the company an out notice to say, we're out and we're not out. They make 3 more minutes worth of their pay.
Right. And you think, everybody in here is going 3 more minutes, but 3 more minutes times, right. And they're risking their career because typically if you have that behavior, other companies, I won't speak towards airlines, but a lot of, because they might be a little desperate for pilots, but the cashiers and things like that, those you can get other jobs, but they're risking a career over 3 minutes. But from the company standpoint, 3 minutes times how many pilots do they have times how many times do they do it? You start talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars, surely. So they're bent on making that money any way they can. The trick, I used to work at Walmart, so the trick people used to do is they would stand at the clock, right? And they would, boop, they'd badge in, and then they would stand there and just wait. Because you could clock in 9 minutes early and it not be a problem. So they clock in 9 minutes early, and then they just hang out. And then if a manager came by, and I was an intern, so nobody respected me, hey, did you clock in? I need you up front. Oh, no, huh? So then what would I do? I'd go and I'd pull the timesheet right then and go, hey, you clocked in, get up front. Because we couldn't keep cashiers, so I didn't want to fire them, but at the same time, don't just stand there. But they were riding the clock for just a mere tiny bit, but to them it was enough to, they were willing to send to get that little bit. It's an extra hour a week, if you really think about it, an extra two.
In all fairness, you could be on the phone, you could be checking email, you could be, there's a lot of things before God that he knows how we're working, that still you could be being paid.
Oh, yeah.
Not working. And I know we're not robots. You might talk to a coworker. I'm not saying we're,
right.
we're in a straitjacket, but we also, have to look at what we're,
very true, because if you're supposed to be doing something for your employer, but you're surfing the internet, then yeah, those are bad things. Now, I'm fortunate. I work at a company that most everybody just stands around and talks all the time. There's not a lot of hurry up and do with heavy equipment. As long as it gets done, nobody really cares. But our sales department, they hang out. And it gets everybody that works in the office that has to kind of, it's a challenge for me just to be like, we might not have to work so hard if you guys would go out and sell more equipment. And plus, you're loud and obnoxious, and you talk too much. So absolutely. If your job is to do one thing and you're focusing on other things, that's the same thing.
I'll just add to that because I've thought about that before. My job is kind of a weird.
Yes, you are weird. Yes.
When the Brexit thing happened, I hadn't been doing a lot of follow up on that, and all of a sudden the market tanks 600 points on Friday. So I spent some time reading the news.
Right.
About what are the financial implications to that? And that didn't really help Pinnacle Bank at all, my employer when I was doing that, but it was like, that's something I've got to do.
Right.
So some of it, it's a judgment call, it's a conscious thing. It's a matter of kind of what you're, if you don't have that sort of job where you're clocking in, clocking out,
right.
It can be, that gray area that you want to make sure your conscience is clean before the Lord, going, okay, am I working heartily as I'm doing research or whatever, on this thing? So it changes over time, either from when you're working at Safeway where I work, where working means kind of bringing the product to the front and then just doing things that will help in an indirect manner.
Right.
It's
so I did, I did not read any implications of Brexit on heavy equipment this last week. And yeah, I didn't. Yeah. I will probably tomorrow. The president of our company will probably have articles on her desk or send out emails. And so I'll probably spend a good time reading. And that's a true point is, you know, you should be proactive in your job, not reactive in it. Do you feel like, so we're still working through is how do you tell if you have a love of money? Do you ever feel like you never seem to have enough? If I didn't get you before, I got you now. Because a lot of times people think, man, I need a raise or I need to maybe get another job because I want to make more money. And sometimes those things may not always be the best thing for you or your family or those around you that if you're so money driven. Do you hate to give? Do you begrudgingly sign the check and put it wherever you put it? That's a sign. And then, of course, the last ones, are you willing to sin to keep it or get it? It goes either way. All right, so we're getting close to the end. If you're a lover of money, you'll do these things. This is what MacArthur says. You will put your trust in money rather than in God. I think we've talked about that one enough, is that a lot of people get comfortable. If you're comfortable and you don't have to worry about where your next meal is coming from, it's real easy to just be focused on other things. But if you live somewhere where you're depending on kindness of strangers, blessing of God to get your next meal, you'll have a different attitude about money. You might just have a general attitude of, I don't need God. I have everything I need. A lot of times that can get wrapped up in materialism. And you don't have to think mansions and yachts. You can think, I have a comfortable apartment with a car that gets me to point A to point B. Your life, if you have a love of money, your life will be on built on fleeting, unstable foundations because it's not built on God. Jobs change. Economies tank. I read articles, and it's kind of funny because in London, the wealthiest, you know, group of Londoners, or I guess people of Great Britain, whatever you call them, people over there, they lost like $127 billion. Big deal. Because when you look at it to scale, they each lost a couple of million dollars. And to us, that's horrible. But on Thursday, when the pound goes back up and market stabilize, they'll make it all back up. But they have so much money that a couple million dollars is not that big of a deal to them, because you have to look at scale. If most people in here lost $2, so what? I'll get it back. That's how they look at things. And it's a very skewed reality because we don't live in that world. Love of money will certainly make you proud. A lot of people love to flaunt their money. I don't think we need to say anything else about it. And then you'll make an idol out of money. You said that. If making an idol out of money is probably one of the worst things you can do, because you're then worshiping yourself. You're worshiping a product, a tangible thing that is just, it's not going to do anything for you. It's a fleeting thing. It can come today and leave tomorrow. You can mismanage it and lose it all. All those things happen. So you don't want to make an idol out of money. So I'm going to close with one of the weirdest things I'm ever going to close with is Benjamin Watson. Does anybody know who Benjamin Watson is? He's a football player in the NFL. So when you think football player in the NFL, you think theologian, right? So Jen, I don't have a Facebook account. Jen does. Jen follows him. I don't even know how you ended up following him. But it's not, hey, look how great I am. He's always, and he's dead on all the time. And this one, she sent it to me just the other day. It popped up. Materialism is a condition of the heart and not your wallet. And, it, you know, so here's this guy that makes millions of dollars. And easy for him to say, I know, but he seems to actually live that out. And I know, I just wanted to kind of jokingly throw it out there, is that it's a true statement, is that if you have a big problem with materialism, then that's a problem with your heart, not necessarily a problem with your wallet. So does anybody have any questions, comments, concerns? Don't turn it off. It's about to turn it off. The 12 minutes left are for applicable questions. Can we answer your question?
Let me ask, just play devil's advocate with the interest, the stuff, the credit card offers. So how would you direct somebody to get, let's say they go to school at 22, they graduate college, they get a job, and then a few years later, they and their spouse want to buy a house, and the mortgage company would like to see, they pull a credit report. So how, I mean, if they don't have any credit, how would they be able to buy a house?
Okay, so if you don't have credit, there's cheap ways to do it. The cheapest thing to do is to get an incredibly small line of credit. I'm talking $300-$500 through a department store. JCPenney's, what are department stores? Profits, is that a Profits a thing anymore? Belk, Macy's, whatever those type of places are. Even Old Navy will do it. Does everybody know how a credit report works? Okay, there's three major credit report companies, Experian, TransUnion, Equifax. When you are a every company in America is a subscriber to those. So what happens is when you get a credit card, it goes on your credit report. When a company, like a mortgage company, pulls your credit report, it'll show all your credit history. So if you want to start your credit, you can go and get a small, that's the key word, small line of credit, and use it. But pay it off every month. When you get your statement, if you pay it off on or before your due date, you'll not be charged any interest. If you roll that month, then you're going to pay the full month's interest. Rolling be, you just pay the minimum payment. So go and buy a t-shirt or go and buy something, and that'll actually establish you a credit line. When you start talking about mortgages, that's probably not going to be enough to generate trust, right, to get to the mortgage level, but it's a start. You can finance cars. What I would do is I've counseled people to do this before is, how much money do you have to buy a car? Well, I've saved up $6,000. Okay, well, let's go find you an $8,000 car. You finance $2,000. You have it for a year. You pay a little bit of interest on it, but you also will get the benefit of having credit. That's if you want to have credit. If you don't want to have credit, and I deal with these country boys that will come in and drop $100,000 in cash on your desk and buy an excavator. We've done that twice in the last 5 years where these men who have been in business for 30, 40 years have zero credit. And we look at them like, no, we can't do anything for you. A finance company won't touch those guys because they don't have any credit history. But they may have hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars in the bank. So long story short, if you're eventually wanting to buy a home and you don't want to pay cash for it, then you're going to have to start building credit. And there's some ways to do it in a very inexpensive way. You don't want to go get a $10,000 loan just for fun. That doesn't make any sense.
You're not saying, though, no credit card.
I'm not anti-credit card. If you have a problem with credit card, if you're financially undisciplined, then I would recommend you stay away from credit cards. I go the opposite direction. I benefit from credit card usage. I think some of us would if you have points. Yeah, I'm getting some shakes of the head, yeah. You can make money on your credit card, but you have to be disciplined with it. Because the minute you don't, there goes all your rewards. So you've cost yourself.
You're right, you can make money, but if you're trying to live within a monthly budget and you buy something this month, you're not going to pay until next month.
Right.
And so that throws this month's budget off when you bought it then.
Yes. Those are all things right. That comes the discipline. What I do is I actually run a reverse spreadsheet, right? So the money I put on my credit card is money that I owe. So I basically treat that spreadsheet as a debiting list. So I have income, savings, all these things, and then that's my disposable income, and then whatever I charge on my income comes off of that balance. And when I hit zero, I've spent all my money. And then that way, I'm always a month ahead. So also known as a balance sheet. If you do it in a spreadsheet, you can do it on a piece of paper, you can do it on a check ledger, whatever. I built a spreadsheet because I like spreadsheets. It's an easy way to keep up with it. So I'm not anti-credit card, but I am anti not being responsible with them.
So we had a problem when we tried to move here because we sold our house in Missouri and we went to seminary for 3 years. And because the credit card that we had used, we'd never used anything for anything except for putting gas in the cars to go on youth trips. Which then we would pay off within 10 days after we got back from the youth trip.
Right.
So we never acquired any debt. So our credit score was quite roof. We put $15,000 on our credit card and paid off within 5 days because it was going on youth camps and mission trips.
Right.
So we went to seminary and lived hand to mouth. And then we tried to come here and buy a house and they would not get us a loan because our credit was too good. Because we didn't have any debt on our, and we couldn't figure it out. That was just weird. So what was the financial understanding from the bank behind Zed?
So all these are based on algorithms, and the joke used to be there's only three guys in the world that know how they work. The guy who runs Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. So you'd have to ask him how it really works, but bottom lining it is we look for similar trade lines being your credit history. So if you have a credit card balance or a credit card limit of $10,000 but you don't have a balance, that's a trade line. That's what they call it. So a lot of times if the banks look at, you've got maybe two credit cards, you've got a high score, but you don't have any comparable credit. So the comparable credit would be, today I go get a $5,000 line of credit on a credit card, and I handle that well for 6 months to a year. Then I go and buy a car, and I apply for a loan to finance a $10,000 car. They're going to look at it and go, okay, well, he handled this $5,000 well, this $5,000 line of credit well. We'll see how he does with 10. And so then you get that $10,000 car. And so you pay on it well, and then you go and you're like, you know, I'm going to go and I'm going to borrow money for a boat or whatever foolish thing you can think of. And you stair step it up. That's how they kind of generate that. A lot of times people will get credit for their student loans. So if you're a student and you graduate college and you're carrying $40,000-$50,000 of student loan, you have good payment history with it, it's going to be easier for you to buy a house than somebody who's, you know, maybe went on a scholarship, didn't incur the debt, and has a $5,000 credit card in their name. It's just how the banks look at it. When a lot of times we'll have people apply for, say, a $300,000 piece of equipment, but they've only always bought used equipment at the $75,000 range. What we'll say, we'll approve those people, but we require a massive amount of money down, or we'll build in some sort of payment structure that makes us more comfortable with it. So that's where the banks look at things not like you think they would. You know, hey, I've done everything I'm supposed to do. I've met my responsibilities. Give me this $150,000 loan. And they go, no. I don't trust you that much. That's what they said, basically.
So we paid off everything always forever and ever, and then we'll give us
forever. Right.
So pretty much. So in line with that, my question is, how do those of us who live responsibly play that game so we can be in a position to get a mortgage in the future? We've never had.
Deal with local banks. I wouldn't play the game. If you've got good credit, keep good credit. If you're 18 trying to get credit, that's when I would say try and maybe build some credit. But if you're an adult and you have good credit, you shop around. You don't need to play the game. Don't go and incur a large loan or a large line of credit just to, you know, beef up your credit. You don't need to do that. You just find a local bank. Andy's Bank is not a typical mortgage lender, but Home Federal, the credit unions, if you can go in there and they have a different view of things. Credit unions... Are you pro credit union?
Yeah.
I used to always joke about being anti credit union, but I have an account at a credit union. They just look at things differently. They're more common sense driven on certain things.
Or relationship.
And they're big on relationship. Mm-hmm. If you, I will bring everything I have, even though it's $12. They will say, okay, what can we do for you? And they'll treat you just fine. ORNL, Y-12. As long as you live in the community or work or go to church in the community, they'll open an account for you. And they're very nice. I've never had a bad experience with any of those folks.
And the reason for that is because the people who are making the decisions, they're making it for you and going on right to the next person, right? So they're looking at your score. They're looking at that. If it's 700 score, we'll give you a loan. If not, we're not moving along. So Dave Ramsey will refer people to Churchill Mortgage. Somebody ever heard that? Maybe ever listened to them. And then they do manual underwriting. They're a company in Nashville. And I was wondering if anybody had any experience with that, because they will look and say, oh, okay, you're a renter, you have no credit history, we'll go to your what's the renter's name, the landlord,
right,
and say, okay, show me the payment history here, and they'll do what's called manual underwriting, a little bit more work, but it's somebody who's actually making a human decision, not a credit score decision.
Right.
What is to get a mortgage without a credit score?
And what Andy's talking about is matrix lending. You'll hear that thrown out. If you don't fit in the box, you don't get the loan.
Yeah.
Those common sense lenders are going away. They've actually approached me and my job to actually start maybe looking at building a matrix system, and I just keep telling them no because it's a lot of work and I don't want to do it. But it takes away the commonality and the common sense of, well, if this guy's got a 790 credit score but no comparable trade line, you know, we're still going to have to manually underwrite to some degree. But matrix lending is very much, if you fit in the box, great, and if you don't, we got other stuff to do. So, and that's what that's how they look at people now.
And a funny story, just a quick thing, anyway, a few of it. I've got a client with $4 million in the bank who got turned down for a $400,000 loan because his credit score dropped because he applied for a Costco credit card, then went on a month-long vacation. The bill came, he didn't pay it, and so his score didn't fit in the box. And, you know, he's one of those guys that just is not understanding about things like that, you know. And so my job and my role in that was to calm him down and say, listen, you know, it's not you, it's us. You know, it's us as the financial industry. But, you know, he had to wait 6-9 months until his score came back up from that late payment, that 30-day late payment. And, you know, the guy's got more money that he could pay cash for his house. But he's got to play the game.
Right.
You know, it's
tax deductions and things like that. I've got a similar story. I have a buddy that's for 10 years been trying to build an assisted living facility, which is a multi-million-dollar project. He had 5 Knoxville-based cardiologists. So they're in Knoxville, right? They're here. You can go look at them and touch them. 5 Knoxville-based cardiologists with multi-millions of dollars. And they just wanted to borrow $6 or $7 million, and they couldn't get a bank to lend them the money just because of the turmoil in the market. So if something like that happens to you, don't take it personally. Just there's another lender out there. And if you need, find somebody like Andy or me even, and we'll help you find somebody. So thanks for your time. Class is over. Thank you.